Do you want to learn how to invest, or are you an entrepreneur and want to build companies in the regenerative food and agriculture space? Or do you work in big ag and big food and want to really move the needle? We have developed a new video course for you. Find out more on investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/course or in the show notes description below. Why would you, after founding a successful local animal protein, direct-to-consumer, grass-fed, grass-finished, all the good stuff, business, decide to start, wait for it, a bank? And not just any bank built for an exit, like one of these fancy fintech companies. No, a mutual one, which is basically a cooperative owned by the customers and the depositors. And to make matters worse, the last mutual bank in the US was started over 50 years ago. It's safe to say that the regulators weren't going easy on our guest of today, and for good reasons, when he started his bank. Why starting a bank might be the most impactful thing you can do in your regional food system. That's what we're going to talk about. Plus, why accounting is so incredibly interesting. Where you bank really, really matters. Why there are no silver bullets in regeneration. And why long-term investment options, specifically for land, are fundamental. Enjoy. This is the Investing in Regenerative Agriculture and Food podcast, Investing as if the planet mattered, where we talk to the pioneers in the regenerative food and agriculture space to learn more on how to put our money to work to regenerate soil, people, local communities, and ecosystems while making an appropriate and fair return. Why my focus on soil and regeneration? Because so many of the pressing issues we face today have their roots in how we treat our land and our sea, grow our food, what we eat, wear and consume. And it's time that we as investors, big and small, and consumers start paying much more attention to the dirt/soil underneath our feet. To make it easy for fans to support our work, we launched our membership community, and so many of you have joined us as a member. Thank you. If our work created value for you, and if you have the means, and only if you have the means, consider joining us. Find out more on gumroad.com/investinginregenag. That is gumroad.com/investinginregenag. Or find the link below. Welcome to another episode, today with the founder and CEO of Walden Mutual Bank. Welcome, Charlie.
Thanks so much for having me, Con.
And to start with a personal question I always like to ask at the beginning, we're going to get to why you started a bank, but that's a different, the meat of this discussion. But also, how did you get into, because it's a very specific focused bank, how did you get into, the local food scene? How do you get into regenerative agriculture and food? Usually ask them why soil? Why, from all the career paths you could have chosen and probably other fintech companies you could have started, why one that focuses so much on the few inches of topsoil beneath our feet?
Well, so I grew up on Cape Cod, which is this sort of beautiful summer destination. I grew up scooping ice cream and frying seafood. And there was a proposal in the early 2000s to put the first offshore wind farm in the country off the coast of Cape Cod and in Nantucket Sound. And this became...
This is the U.S., just for our international listeners, yeah.
Yes, yes.
The first one in the country, people were thinking, okay, you didn't have one before. This is a long, this is a whole different podcast about energy systems, why it took so long. You're getting there. But there was an interesting proposal, for putting one wind farm in a very progressive area normally, where the progressive... People
indeed,
we're going on holiday. Yeah.
Yes, and in fact, this became one of the most contentious energy projects that the U.S. has seen in many decades. Much more so than a nuclear power plant. And in fact, you had some of the most notable progressives, the Kennedy family amongst them, come out against this project, saying we're for wind and we're all for wind energy, but just not here, not in our backyard.
So the NIMBY effect was ridiculously strong. Yeah.
Yeah. This is where I learned the definition of the term NIMBY. But we were talking about standing on the beach and at arm's length, a quarter inch on the horizon was the visual impact we were talking about. And people made so many funny arguments, like this is you wouldn't put a wind farm in the Grand Canyon and all of this stuff. It just, and when to me, the alternative was quite literally a coal plant in someone else's backyard. It just, I had a really hard time reconciling that. And so I spent a lot of time many years later in California's Central Valley, which is the most agriculturally productive area on the entire planet. And that was really sort of my entree to industrial agriculture. And it was so interesting relative to this experience with this proposed offshore wind farm, which, by the way, never got built.
So they won. Yeah.
They won. And it just became clear to me that, and this is true of banking too, when it comes to all things, energy, agriculture, waste, all things natural resources, when it's sort of out of sight, out of mind, it's someone else's problem somewhere else. And that leads to such negative consequences. You know, to me, Hunger Games was such a, this is a horribly dystopian view, setting aside the, you know, competition with people killing each other, just the setup of the society portrayed in that movie where you have these rural sectors toiling on behalf of the urban elite. And they have different sources of information, different educational systems, different access to capital. To me, there were elements of that movie that were just a little bit too real.
And it's the first time somebody brings the Hunger Games up, but in this whole 250 plus, but it's a very, I mean, I'm now thinking about it, surprised that it hasn't come up before, because that's what we've been partly creating.
So that's why I've become such a fervent believer in regionalized food systems, but would also apply that same lens to energy, waste, all things natural resources. Because again, when it's someone else's problem somewhere else, that just leads to really terrible consequences, environmentally, but also in the long term, potentially socially and politically.
It needs to be touchable, almost in your face, for us to take good care of it. Like, as soon as it's out of sight, it just doesn't hit us hard enough to really do something about it. And then why did you, because you had experience in energy, or you at least saw that whole battle, then what brought you to food? Because also in energy, there's a lot of work to be done, let's say, as you alluded to before. What made you focus on, I'm always saying, quote unquote, the other big transition we need? Of course, there's waste and other streams, but let's say food and energy seem to be the two big systems that need a massive transition. Why you ended up in the Central Valley to begin with?
Well, I was working for a venture-backed composting company. And so I was traveling up and down the 99, which is sort of the primary highway there. And as I said, this is the most agriculturally productive place on the planet. People don't realize what that means, but this valley produces like 50% of the country's major cash crops, from tomatoes to raspberries to strawberries, and 80 to 90% of the world's almonds and walnuts and things like that, just like crazy numbers. And yet you visit these communities, and two things were very sort of stark observations for me. One was, there's nowhere to eat in the valley except for Arby's and McDonald's. And that's such a weird dichotomy that the people who live there can't really literally enjoy the fruits of their labor. And two, these communities are bearing the brunt of this industrial food system in a way that in urban areas are not at all. And so you walk through some of these towns that have, for example, an egg laying facility, and the smell of ammonia on just walking down the sidewalk, to me, was completely overwhelming. Like, not just uncomfortable to be outside, like really pervasive. And for the people who live there, it's just an accepted part of living in that community. And compare that to the political power of, you know, folks that live in Hyannisport that didn't want to see this wind farm 10 miles off the coast. it's just like, I've just found that really hard to reconcile. So my wife and I moved back east in 2013. She started working on an organic vegetable farm. We read a handful of books together. That was a few years after Michael Pollan's Omnivore's Dilemma came out. We were both just really motivated to understand the local food ecosystem and dig into what was missing. So around the time she started farming, I started putting together plans to start Walden Local, which is a brand of local sustainable meat, pasture-based meat. So we bought a truck in 2013 and started buying whole animals and distributing them to, at first, 50 pilot families that sort of bought into essentially shares of these animals. And then spent 8 or 9 years growing it. So fast forward to today, the company serves about 30,000 individual families from Central Jersey to Portland, Maine, with a monthly delivery of grass-fed beef, pasture-raised pork, chicken, lamb, and then increasingly a variety of other ancillary products like raw milk cheeses and grass-fed butter and things like that.
The good stuff.
Yeah.
Why the animal protein side? Because you said specifically you could also started farming. I mean, your wife did. And you read a number of books. I think many people are in that phase maybe now as well. Maybe some are listening as well. Like, how did you narrow down the focus? And then we get to how that led to a bank, which is not such a logical step, or at least not one that you hear every day. But how did you narrowed it down, like of the tens of options you probably had to start an animal protein?
One gets back to the question you asked before, which I didn't answer, which is why soil? So people don't realize that, yes, animals eat plants, but plants also eat animals. And ruminant animals, animals that eat grass, like cows and sheep, play this amazing role from an ecosystem services perspective of building soil and specifically holding carbon in the soil. So if you look at just from a very high level perspective, there's three times the amount of carbon in the soil as there is in the entire atmosphere plus all plant and animal life combined. Let me just say that one more time. There's three times the amount of carbon in the soil relative to all plant and animal life plus everything we've put in the atmosphere since humans came into the existence, three times the amount. And so what any sort of carbon strategy really has to address soil's potential as a carbon sink. Another way to think about soil from that perspective is 50% of what's emitted in terms of CO2 remains in the atmosphere. And then the other 50%, 25 gets absorbed by the ocean and 25% gets absorbed by land, by soil. And so we spend all of our time talking about the portion that is flowing into the atmosphere. But look at what is being absorbed by the soil. If that 25% goes to 30 or 40%, that is a sea change in terms of our ability to sort of handle carbon on an ongoing basis. So anyway, a lot more to say about that, but that pasture-based animal agriculture, I think, is a huge part of the climate solve. But also maybe a more local answer was, this isn't a particularly productive place to grow monoculture row crops. If you want to be a corn or soy farmer, Massachusetts and New Hampshire are generally not at the top of your list. We have hilly, rocky soils. We have a short annual growing season. We have Boston gets more annual rainfall than Seattle. Seattle has more rainy days, but we get about 12 inches of additional rain here. Anyway, all those things combined.
Perfect grassland.
Yeah. It's actually, in fact, one of the most productive places, certainly in the U.S., to grow perennial pasture. And that makes it a really amazing place to grow ruminant animals, animals that eat grass. There's also this element of farms tend to be smaller in the Northeast, and they're actually very close to urban areas. So compare that to, say, the Midwest. Not only is it not possible here to put together, you know, 10,000 contiguous acres very easily, the farms that are here tend to be pretty close to urban areas. And so the business that we've built at Wild and Local sort of reflects all of those things. And it makes a lot of sense in this region of the country, you know, relative to other options from a land use perspective. I sort of had the theory that this is the highest and best use of available land here.
And do you remember when it clicked for you, the role of ruminants in rebuilding soil, storing water capacity, carbon, soil carbon, etc.? Because I don't think Central Valley is such a grazing area, let's say. It's not that you've seen massive right. examples of holistic managed grazing there. Do you remember? Was it the omnivore's dilemma? Was it Dan Barber? Was it what was the trigger? Because it goes against, I mean, not on this show particularly, because we've had many, many people on the grazing side, but let's say in the general public, it's still very much the cow and not the how. Do you remember when that that clicked with you, if there was a specific moment, specific documentary, specific visit to some place?
There were a couple of books that my wife and I read on our way back from California, moving back east. One was Omnivore's Dilemma. Another was Kristen Kimball's book about her, very much romanticizes small-scale farming in the Northeast. I'm blanking on the name of it, but she's an amazing writer. Just a really fun book to read. But even more than that, because of those books, we started engaging with local farmers and tasting their products. And it was really this, we met this amazing local farmer named Steve, and he raised pasture-raised chickens and pigs and cows. And I think he's actually originally from Australia, and he just had this amazing way of describing what he was doing to the land and why it created a better tasting product. And we brought home a couple of chickens and cooked them for some friends of ours. And it just, the taste really blew us away.
After eating not amazingly, let's say, after 99 in Central Valley.
Yeah.
The contrast was interesting.
Exactly. And there was just this really positive moment where we're talking about Steve and all the things he's doing. And it was just sort of like great food and great conversation. And that sounds so silly, but I had had other experiences, and I'm sure you've seen that too, where if we're trying to change other people's behaviors, we're often sort of, my first impulse is like, sort of put all the negative things in front of them around the consequences of their behavior
and hope they change.
Yeah. You know, make them feel guilty about it. But then I look at my own behavior and I'm like, actually, for example, you know, you look at sort of the methods that PETA uses and show people the terrible consequences of industrial agriculture and animal suffering and such. And it's the same in the sort of abortion movement. And ultimately those images, you know, they're fleeting. People are affected by them for
smoking
20 minutes
as well. Yeah. And then,
you know, a day or two later, they're totally forgotten. It's hard to change behavior that way. It's hard to change sort of fundamental beliefs. And so what I've seen changing minds, because it's sort of changed my own mind, is just the inspiration that comes from really positive experiences and the positive alternative. So anyway, that I don't know if I answered your original question or not. You got me going for too long, but that was sort of the original inspiration.
Absolutely. And then running a successful meat delivery and meat processing and marketing company, obviously you start a bank. I mean, that's just the most logical thing to do in your spare time. How did that come about? Like, what's the step there to say, okay, we actually need to start financing in the space around us much more than current banks or current offerings in the Pacific Northwest are doing?
Well, it came from a couple of places. One, our mission at the bank, it's a little cheeky, but or our ethos rather, is to grow your change. And it's a little cheeky because it's a double entendre. Obviously, we want to help people grow their savings, but also grow their ability to change this, in our case, local food ecosystem. So the mission underlying that is we enable anyone to make positive and lasting change to our local food ecosystem.
And you mean local Hudson Valley, I said Pacific Northwest, obviously completely the other side. You mean upstate New York, Hudson, that area?
Yeah, we're really focused on New York and New England. Yeah.
Okay, and grow your change. So let's specifically focus on, let's say I have savings and I live there and I want to move part of that or even all of that. Like, do I move everything and do I cut my credit cards and lines with the big evil banks? Or what's the, like, is it a radical transition in that sense? Or is it partly?
It can be anything. So one, we take depositors from anywhere. So you don't have to live in the region to be a depositor at the bank. But we're focused from a lending perspective on our local food shed.
Do you see a lot of people from outside to
yes, join? Yeah. Surprisingly so. And perhaps that's because people are keen to the fact that where you bank actually really matters. And what I mean by that is when you bank at one of the top five largest banks in the U.S., and this is true internationally as well, I just don't know the specific players as well. $100,000 in a bank account with one of the top five banks is equivalent to the average American's carbon impact for an entire year. Driving, flying, eating, purchasing, whatever. And wow. The reason is because the top five banks in this country are the single largest investors in fossil fuel development. $1.2 trillion since the Paris Accords were signed. And ultimately, that's your money. And so trying to devise an alternative for a depositor that wanted to have an impact with their deposit dollars, the same way that people have shown a desire to do with investment dollars, that was a big part of the impetus. The other part of it was, at Walden Local, we were so often in a position of lending to various entities in our supply chain, not just farms, but also value-added manufacturers and different distribution partners.
You became sort of a bank by
default. Yeah, and that wasn't really the business we intended to be in. But it did suggest there was a pretty interesting gap in the existing lending infrastructure.
And so how difficult is that to start? Like, it's not that you wake up one day, obviously, and you have a bank. Like, what's the process like to... I can't imagine very long, but like, what does it, like, when you came to the realization, okay, we need to start our own bank, to the moment you officially opened for depositors to be able to wire and open accounts and wire their money in, like, how long did that take?
About 2 years, start to finish.
Not that bad.
Well, it seemed pretty bad at the time. I don't know if I would recommend the process to someone else, but it's, there's obviously,
you would do it faster now. If somebody would ask you, okay, I'm in another region where local food starts to become very important, like, how would you do it? Or maybe you do it yourself. I'm imagining there are some tricks or some things, you know, okay, these are the steps to do, or it's anyway such a, I mean, starting a bank, especially in these climates, sounds like a a long journey?
I think it might be a little bit faster if we, like, you know, try to set up again and do it again. We would do some things differently. And obviously there are a lot of lessons learned. However, we didn't make it easy for ourselves. I mean, the reason, and that was largely a result of the sort of regulatory process to get the charter over the finish line. And under any circumstance, that's a long, arduous process.
So you just need to know it's going to take 2 years. You just need to be aware. Were you aware that it was going to take 2 years, or you thought faster? Maybe that
was the thing. No, I think our expectation was more like a year. But we made a series of choices that made the application much more difficult from a regulatory standpoint. So one of those was being focused on a much larger geographic area than a typical new bank is, being digitally oriented. So we don't actually have cash services. We have a physical location, but it's not really a bank branch. And then three, we're structured as a mutual. A lot of people have become less familiar with that term over time, but it's essentially a cooperative structure in which the bank is ultimately owned by its depositors. And there hasn't been a new mutual started in the US in about 50 years. So that combination of things, particularly the mutual element of it, just was, flashing red lights at regulators to like really dig in and understand this, understandably so. I mean, from their perspective, it should be an arduous process. You don't want to allow anyone to just start a bank and open it tomorrow. It's important that there's a pretty big set of hurdles to jump over there. But we didn't make it any easier for ourselves.
So where are you now? We're talking summer, I mean, Northern Hemisphere summer 2023, Walden Mutual Bank. How would you describe it now in terms of size, in terms of what kind of numbers can you share, just to give us an idea of what we're talking about in terms of the bank?
Yeah, we opened for depositors about 6 months ago. We're probably somewhere around $60 million or so in assets. We've got a really amazing loan portfolio of, I think, some of the most notable entrepreneurs and companies across the entire value chain. So everything from production farms to manufacturers to distributors to some awesome consumer brands. And then also things that are sort of on the periphery of that ecosystem, but help support the functioning of the whole.
Have you invested in compost yet? Considering your
We've looked at a couple composting opportunities. We have this amazing dog treat business that sort of upcycles waste streams from area farm and food businesses. So I think we're off to a good start.
And I mean, 6 months is of course long and short at the same time. What's your biggest surprise?
I think everything about banking takes patience, and that is not a quality that comes to me very easily. And there's an element of that as just also for good reason. The industry is pretty risk averse, and the safety and soundness of the bank is a key consideration, not just for regulators, but for our management team and board. And so the push-pull between wanting to do sort of new innovative things and move quickly on them, and also sort of constraining ourselves to obviously protect depositors and the overall sort of, nature of the bank itself, that's been an interesting journey.
Coming from, a company you were, of course, founding yourself, and before that in a VC-backed startup where probably everything like break it and then ask for permission, which is not the case you should do with a bank. Like that's like, you do that once and it was the end of the story. Yeah.
Exactly. And I had a lot of experience in a heavily regulated industry. We, co-own and operate a slaughter and processing plant up in Vermont, and there's a USDA inspector on site every single day. And you can't operate without them. And so that regulatory relationship is obviously really important. So I sort of had this concept of, oh, I know what that means. But banking is really different. It's not accurate to say that banks are heavily regulated. It's more that banks are essentially public utilities. And so the regulators are, if you're doing it right, partners in the enterprise. I mean, they are a key stakeholder in the same way that investors or depositors or borrowers are. And so that mentality, I think, has served us well, but that has definitely been a lesson learned.
And I mean, you cannot say a conclusive yes, probably, but your thesis that this piece was missing or is missing in the food system specifically where you operate, like that I was missing a local bank focused on the local food scene. What would be your answer now? Like, it's that has been absolutely true. You said we have an amazing loan portfolio. I'm assuming they couldn't raise against those terms somewhere else. Like, have you filled a gap with the bank in the first 6 months? Do you have the feeling like you have had a lot of interesting additionality, let's say?
Yes, absolutely. There are so many opportunities we see where, you know, despite what we think is a really solid underlying business, they, for whatever reason, they've had trouble getting an audience with the sort of normal bank. And so that's why we're here. So that gap definitely exists and is maybe even larger than I had thought previously. There's so many people that are really eager to work with a lender that is not just sort of understands this ecosystem, but is really deeply immersed in it. And so we're able to bring a lot of resources and people to bear in a lending relationship that sort of harkens back to the way a bank maybe was 100 years ago, but certainly the larger institutions have gotten away from, where you know, we've got some amazing expertise in our network. If you're an operator that is having issues with distribution or inventory management or marketing, or just so very easily able to connect them with other folks in our broader network, and that sort of serves the whole ecosystem well. We're also trying to connect borrowers and depositors in a way that has not been true at a bank for a long time. So our depositors are generally sort of farmers market shoppers as a proxy. They're people who are engaged in the local food movement. They want access to these types of farms and businesses. They want to go visit them. They want to go to events. They want, you know, discounts, samples, whatever. And then you look at these businesses and farms, they want any opportunity to engage with that segment. These are their core customers. And so wherever we can facilitate those connections, again, also, I think sort of serves the ecosystem well long-term.
And I saw on a website you're launching a 100-year product. What's up with that? What's up with the local impact certificate of deposit? It's a mouthful, or local impact CD. Why is that such a revolutionary process? As I saw, I think it's the first of a kind. What's the reasoning behind launching that? And what is it exactly, and why does it serve the system?
Yeah, so one thing we see on the farm side is land values are such that oftentimes the income profile of a small farm cannot support a loan for the land that amortizes over 10 or 15 years. And generally,
plain English, the prices, for whatever reason, speculation, land, like the price have gone up quite a lot, and the productive capacity to serve a loan to in 10, 15 years is just not there.
The annual payments
to
greater get that. Than, or the monthly payments end up being greater than what you could expect from a cash flow.
So you cannot borrow money to a farm to buy the neighbor or to expand, because it's just from a banking perspective, and coming back to that, the bank needs to be sound. It just doesn't make sense to write a loan.
Generally, banks don't want to write 30-year loans unless they are selling them right away. And so, for example, consumer mortgages, most banks sell the bulk of the consumer mortgages that they generate right away, because there's a very active market in the form of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that sort of helps banks essentially manage their balance sheet. So I guess backing up a second, what banks fundamentally do is take what are ultimately short-term on-demand deposits and magically transform them into long-term loans. That's like the bank's fundamental role in the economy. And so it's very difficult to justify a 30-year loan from a sort of safety and soundness perspective, because you have to know that you have 30-year money to support that loan. And this isn't just in the case of a run on deposits. It's more just understanding how to match those two durations.
It's not the role as a bank to hold those loans. It's the role to create them, but then you need to, like a mortgage, sell it somewhere else and not to hold them on your balance sheet for 30 years. It's just not
very hard for a bank to take that risk, because if interest rates change, if your deposit base changes, it's just a long time. And
it's something we've heard a lot, actually, on the land side, I think globally as well. Of course, many places suffer from high land prices, and then what to do? Either you're forced into extremely extracting even more value from the soil to pay a shorter term loan, 10 years, still a lot, but it's nothing in farming. Or you need to find solutions either with land trusts or getting out of that wheel, or come up with other solutions to lengthen that time from 15 years onwards.
Land trusts and conservation easements and stuff are applicable in some situations. Not all property has, or rather some property has more conservation value than others. And so in some cases that can't bridge the whole gap. But ultimately a very straightforward way to reduce the monthly payment required is to extend the maturity of the loan. And so the question was, well, how can we write 30-year loans, or at least experiment in writing loans that long and holding them on our books? Because there's no way you could sell these. Well, if we had longer term money, we could do that. And so the 100-year CD is intended to allow us to write loans that long, potentially even longer than 30 years. And for the depositor, it's kind of an interesting addition to the fixed income portion of a portfolio, because a lot of people want, let's say you're really happy about getting 5% in a U.S. Treasury right now. More than likely, you won't be getting that same interest rate a year or 2 years from now. And so a lot of people at the sort of height of a rate cycle would like to extend the duration of their fixed income portfolio. So I'm probably losing the people that are less familiar with the investment world, but
we're bridging the gap between the land and the investment world. So we need to go deep sometimes.
Well, the point is, it can be an interesting addition to a larger portfolio like that, but also for the sort of smaller average investor, this is a risk-free investment. It's backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government through the FDIC. And it compounds over a very long period of time. And so you can either just leave it and let it sit and watch a relatively small investment become quite large. So I think a $100,000 investment turns into an $8.5 million total over 100 years. And so that can be an interesting vehicle.
The magic of compounding interest. Yeah.
Yes.
Don't ever underestimate that. Yeah.
It can be an interesting charitable giving tool that doesn't expose the charity to any sort of variability if you had put it in the stock market. But also it can function much like an annuity where you can pull the interest off penalty free. So you could, you know, every year pull out the interest, or you could wait 20 years and pull out all the interest. So it's actually a more flexible sort of structure than it initially appears.
And then it allows you to do all kinds of different things with time, basically, in farm. So where exactly are you now with this product, or what's the current status? Again, asking, we're in summer of 2023. What's the current level or the current status you're at?
We are just booking the first ones now. We did start waitlisting people because we were sort of at our limit. It looks like we're going to be able to release a few more people off the waitlist, sort of booking them over the course of next week or so. But I think we've gotten a good response from it. It pays $4.75. I think it's been a really interesting mix of people, some larger, some smaller, using it for very different purposes.
So. And then on the other side, have you already been able to do things on the land side or start conversations there and enable things that otherwise wouldn't be possible?
Yeah, we've got a couple pending loans at really long amortization. So it's sort of come together nicely.
Super interesting. And then what would be your, of course, we're not giving investment advice, but let's say I always like to say, let's do this in a real theater, maybe in New York with an audience of the city of Wall Street. What would be your main message you want to give to them? If it's a room full of quote unquote finance people, either managing their own money or other people's money, like of your journey so far, 2.5 years plus, and actually all the years before building up a business in the local food scene, what's your main message to the finance world?
I'm assuming I'm talking to an audience of people that care about impact and they're trying to align.
Otherwise, they wouldn't be there. So they're excited, but maybe a bit new to space. So they're excited after the evening. They've heard a lot of interesting people and stories. But if we want them to remember one thing, because of course you're not going to remember a lot, like you said, you have to experience it to really change something. What would be that main message we'd like to, let's say, drill in their head and they cannot forget the next morning when they go back to work and hopefully do something?
Well, you'll have to give me two, but one,
okay,
two. One is the cash portion
is
of your, of your portfolio. That is, your banking relationship is incredibly impactful. And in fact, probably the most impactful purchasing decision you make as an individual. And so,
forget about your electric car, forget about all the Saturday morning shopping at the farmer's market, your,
depending on how much you have.
Yeah, of course, wayside green, et cetera, but it's a massive one. We often don't consider, okay, don't forget about your banking relationship. Yeah.
It's because it's out of sight, out of mind, but where you bank really matters. So that's message number one is, you know, how can you achieve impact with something as simple as a banking relationship? I think the second is, everybody's looking for silver bullets when it comes to carbon and when it comes to making agriculture more sustainable. And I am pretty sure there aren't any. I don't know that to be true, but if you look at corollaries elsewhere, it sure seems like this isn't going to be solved overnight, and it's not going to be solved by a single technology or a single entity.
And I thought biochar was going to save us all. I'm deeply disappointed.
There are a lot of people that talk that way. And there's also an investment culture that sort of swarms around a single idea, and then it doesn't pan out, and then you sort of see swarming to the next one. And so I think that's just an important caution to have in mind, is there's not going to be a silver bullet. That being said, if there is a silver bullet, The one that I would make a bet on is accounting. And the reason is because what's measured is what's managed. And if we start paying attention to the depletion of natural resources or negative externalities like pollution of air and water, and those companies are forced to integrate that into their financial statements, that really changes the world. And there are a number of efforts underway on that front, from the Sustainable Accounting Standards Board to B Corp to the Impact Weighted Accounts Project at Harvard Business School. And I'm really excited about that because I think that's really what moves the needle and changes our collective understanding of what matters, because without that, we're just sort of flying blind, and the entirety of the impact investment movement is just a collection of sort of disparate, sometimes made up metrics that don't matter and don't provide any sort of commonality or comparability. And as long as that's the case, an annual impact report from a public company, gosh, it sure looks like a marketing pamphlet more than an audited set of financials. And imagine if those two things were one and the same.
It leads naturally, could be the answer for that question actually, to a magic wand question I always like to ask. So if you could change one thing overnight, what would that be? If you had the magic power to do one thing, in this case, it's really one, what would you do?
As it relates, well, that's my answer, but I'll give you another one besides changing accounting. If we could sort of blow it all up and start over, my answer for agriculture would be the same as energy. And that's that we'd have a much more decentralized and therefore resilient system. You know, we saw in the midst of the pandemic the consequences of putting 5% of US pork production under a single roof. Not a single company, a single building. And then when that plant had to shut down, look at the consequences from a larger market perspective. It just created this panic. And so whoever thought that was a good idea should probably move on to a new career. But I think fundamentally, a more decentralized system would avoid some of the negative externalities that the current structure has, where it can't be someone else's problem somewhere else because it's right in front of you. And a lot of people would say, well, that is going to make food dramatically more expensive. And that's sort of an elitist thing to say because not everyone can buy their food at farmers markets. And I find that argument really frustrating because no one has taken the time to deconstruct what we pay for food today. And there's a lot of people part of the movement that try to say, well, look at the cost of, a Snickers bar relative to a cucumber on a per ounce basis. And it's actually much, much cheaper. And our whole perspective on what is expensive and cheap in food is wrong. And everyone should be willing to spend more like 15 or 20% of their budget instead of 10 like we are now. And I find those arguments to be hard to justify. Instead, what I hang my hat on when someone says, well, isn't that more expensive? And isn't
easy
that
for you to say from upstate New York, yeah. How do we feed the rest of the US and the rest of the world and make it accessible?
So, I want to like back away one step and just look at what we spend in the U.S. on agricultural subsidies and corn and soy alone, many billions of dollars. But just as an example, in 2020, the federal farm subsidies, which are by and large go to large companies in three crops, wheat, corn, and soy, totaled $340 per household in 2020. So, and that doesn't include ethanol subsidies, which are like many multiples of that. And we're paying people to grow corn to then put it into automobiles.
So the budget is there. Let's say the food budget is there if we wanted to.
I mean, just, but the, my point is like, those are your dollars too. You paid for that $340 with your money in taxes. But you didn't total it as part of your food budget. And when Hurricane Florence came and destroyed the pork industry in North Carolina and flooded manure lagoons with toxic consequences and cost billions of dollars to clean up, we didn't add $2 to the cost of our pork chops. But those were also your dollars. You paid taxes and you paid for that cleanup. And that was a direct consequence of the way that we decided to raise food. And so just because it's coming from the other pocket, it's sort of disconnected. And it's so hard to respond to someone who says, well, we have the most efficient and lowest cost food production system in the world. And it's, I kind of say like, but well, by what metric? Like, which, why are you allowed to count those dollars, but not these dollars? Because it's the same. And so when you say a pork chop from a pasture-raised animal from a small farm, you know, 20 miles from my house is more expensive than the one that came from this plant in North Dakota that represents 5% of total production in the country, I don't really know what you mean. Like, yes, the sticker price on the product is more, but when you look at the entirety of the system, and I'm not even talking about pricing negative externalities that we don't currently price. I'm talking about the ones that we, like Hurricane Florence, like we actually paid for that. Those were real dollars. And if you total those up, the food system doesn't look as inexpensive as it is at first glance.
Not even talking about the healthcare part of things. I think Rockefeller did an interesting study, or paid for an interesting study. And I think that the total cost of the food system in the US is 3 times what you pay, let's say, at the counter. And most of that is social cost in terms of healthcare. Not even the huge environmental cost. It was very limited, but a massive one, of course, is healthcare. We're running a full nutrient density series on that topic. If you want to know more, just go to the website. But the healthcare piece is a big one. But you're saying even just the direct out of pocket cost to clean up a lot of this mess. And the subsidy piece is so big that you could argue this is so much more affordable if we would have the... And most people don't know. We spend $340 per year, per household, on simply subsidies for three crops. That's it.
So the healthcare element of it is super interesting too, because by and large, the crops and products we're subsidizing...
We're not eating.
We're not eating if they go into ethanol, but two, when we do eat them, they're contributing to all kinds of long-term health problems, from diabetes to obesity. And so I feel like I've had that argument so many times, and it's just, at the end of the day, the sticker price, one is X and the other is Y. And it's hard to get out of that direct comparison. But if you sort of back up two steps and look at the entirety of the system, our existing food system is incredibly expensive and we are all paying for it.
And a question I'd like to ask to switch the seeds, like you had a magic wand, now you no longer have that, but what if you were in charge of quite a considerable amount of money, let's say $1 billion to invest, and this could be extremely long-term. So the only rule is it has to be invested. Part of it maybe can be used for a bit of lobbying, on the side, but let's say most of it has to be put to work and at some point come back. I'm not asking dollar amounts, I'm not asking specific ones, but I'm asking mainly this question to see what practitioners like yourself are focusing on. What would you prioritize if you had, I'm not saying unlimited amount of money, but this is still, with current inflation, it's going down a bit, but still a large sum of money. What would you do?
So I think there are some important enablers of change. One is accounting. Two is a long-term view. So this is the why that the bank is structured as a mutual. It's because it gives our impact model teeth from a governance perspective. We didn't set up the bank to sell it. And so we didn't want a structure that was all the incentives were aligned around selling to a larger institution and walking away from the impact we wanted to have in 5 or 10 years. But by and large, a lot of that impulse comes from an underlying investor urge that generally investments should have a, whatever the number is, 5 to 7 year time horizon. And you're talking about some people with a very large investable amount of capital. In that case, to me, taking a long-term view and in many cases investing in entities that are intended to be perpetual, from cooperatives to mutuals to increasingly they're long familiar to other countries but very new here, sort of these perpetual trust type structures, yes,
steward ownership ones, yeah,
or employee-owned firms that have a really long-term view. I think that's ultimately what gets us away from the quarterly earnings per share shareholder value paradigm, dominant paradigm that we currently find ourselves in. And I would honestly point the finger to the largest investors in the world, universities, hospitals, pension funds.
They should be doing long-term stuff places, by definition. Yeah.
Yeah. All of these places are theoretically perpetual investors, and they're the ones demanding a sort of 5 to 7 or at most 10 year fund cycle. And why those entities, they prefer to pay what are ultimately really just rent-seeking intermediaries along the way to own the same underlying business. So, the pension fund invests in the VC. The VC takes the company public, and then the pension fund invests in the hedge fund, which owns the underlying business. And then a private equity firm takes it private again, and the investor is an LP in the private equity fund.
It's a lot of fees.
Yeah, you're just, and there's an element of the universe just being so large that not every investor can make direct investments. I get that, but the investment management business has just become so incredibly large that it's created this huge gulf between investors that would otherwise make long-term direct investments and the underlying companies. And so because of that insulation, that layer of intermediaries, you get away from an intimate understanding of those companies' impact on a broader set of stakeholders, not just shareholders. So I think having more longer term sort of semi-perpetual investors making direct investments. And there are some trends towards this, would generally be a good thing.
And would you somehow then use that billion, if you would be in full control, to get others to follow that? Like, would there be ways to, because of course a billion is a lot and it's nothing at the same time, to somehow nudge these or pull them in, the hospitals, the insurance companies, the pension funds? Like, what would be ways to turn that one into 100 billion or even more? Without adding layers and management fees and all of that, obviously.
It depends who, I guess maybe back up a second. If we're talking about a university, for example, I'm not sure we want to change that one to 100. You know, I look at Mackenzie Bezos and the way she approached her wealth versus the sort of...
No, I'm saying, how do you use that one to get another 99 to follow you? I'm not saying turn that one into 100 billion, but how do you use that to, I don't know, make university comfortable to always do, also do long-term investment and come alongside you?
I'm not
saying how to 100x that billion, because that would be a whole different discussion.
I got you. Well, my point is, I think there's something really interesting to be said about sort of spending down an endowment like that. And in some ways that can inspire others to sort of take the same approach. I think it comes back to measurement though. The folks that are sort of on the leading edge of this are embracing new measurement tools from an impact perspective and increasingly trying to align around a set of common standards. And I think that ultimately will enforce some discipline on this larger set of investors who might follow you, but it'll also inspire others to do the same.
And as a final question, it's a question I like to ask, inspired by John Kempf, who always asks, it's slightly different on general agriculture, but what do you believe to be true about regenerative agricultures that agriculture that others don't believe to be true? So where are you contrarian when you're among your peers? You've mentioned a few things on accounting, et cetera, but I'm guessing there might be other things.
So a lot of people in the sort of movement, the food movement, generally speaking, try to apply this lens of, you know, wanting to work on the sort of biggest lever, if you will, as it relates to climate change or other environmental issues. And of course, there's an element of that in everything I've described earlier around soil and carbon and such. But I am very weary of extrapolation to say that this thing matters and this thing doesn't, or this is the only wedge that matters when it comes to carbon. And I feel like I hear that a lot. And it reminds me in the energy world of, there were so many people 10, 20 years ago saying, if you look at the way the energy industry has developed over the last 200 years, energy transitions take generations. And i.e., you need to be patient. And look at how long it took us to transition from wood to coal and then coal to natural gas. And so don't expect that adoption curve to look any different. And now fast forward sort of 10 or 20 years since people were saying that really loudly. And in fact, renewables are growing much, much faster than any of those folks imagined, and certainly much faster than if you just extrapolated the same line. And so what I think I think what I'm honing in on of that I believe that maybe others don't is I'm just very weary of people presenting technologies or market forecasts as sort of laws of thermodynamics that cannot be changed.
10 years down the line, isn't this will happen? Or yeah.
Yeah. And then also to take that one step further, this idea, you referenced it earlier when we were talking about food being expensive or not. This idea that you can't feed the world with organic food, or you can't feed the world with pasture-based meat.
1 hour in, you're really bringing up the deep ones. This is a whole different topic. No, that's a whole different one. But my point is, I spend
zero time thinking about that or talking about it because it just doesn't matter. Like you're literally taking a line. It's the equivalent of looking at a graph and taking a line and just extrapolating a linear extension of the line and being like, see, can't make it work. And there are so many conflicting variables in this equation that you can't do that. You can't make those expansive statements around what works or what doesn't, or what moves the needle or doesn't on a global scale. And so my reaction to that, and I think I'm finally answering your question, is just doing right by what makes sense in my own backyard. And in this region of the country, for all the reasons I described earlier, you know, there are some really interesting, what I see as the sort of highest and best use of available land in this region. And that's what makes sense here. And many other people will come to a different conclusion in different areas of the country and different areas of the world. And that's why I don't think we're going to have a single solution here. But I spend very context. little brain power trying to extrapolate that as a solution for the rest of the world, or really trying to come up with, I don't have the hubris to suggest that I have the solution for the whole world other than accounting.
Yeah, I think there's some underlying principles that seem to make a lot of sense. It might not work everywhere. And I think there's a shared conclusion that the current food system and energy system is not serving us in all the way. If you would do accounting properly, would come to a conclusion that it doesn't make a lot of sense. But what will replace it, or what that transition looks like, is going to be messy. It's going to be very different in many places, but it's going to probably involve turning sunlight into something we can eat in some way or form. And as long as you keep those first principles like front and center, soil will play a very important role, not everywhere, but most places. And turning sunlight into something useful will be an important job to do. If it's energy, it's all energy at the end. But if it's energy that we consume directly, or energy that we use for heating, moving, and cooling, and things like that. So yes. I think it's a very fair point. But it goes against the different camps or tribes, I would almost say, in this space and also outside, that are really shouting about the one solution they have, and everything else is irrelevant, which is always is an interesting struggle to see. So, but it's a waste of brain power, and it just delays transition anyway.
It does. Some of that is a generational thing. I feel like there's more young people that have this generally amazing and inspiring desire to work on something that matters, but it very quickly goes to a sort of judgment of like only a couple things really matter, and that just can't be the case.
Although we're saying here soil really matters. I mean, everything.
Yes. Soil really matters.
If you want to eat, yeah, that's the, no, it's an interesting.
But so does the ocean. I mean, I made the point about soil capturing 25% of what's emitted and looking at how do you change that number.
The other 25 still, goes in the ocean. Yeah. And the other
50 there's still 25 in the ocean. Yeah. There's still the other 50% in the atmosphere. We don't talk a lot about, there are two problems here when it comes to carbon. One is the stock of existing carbon in the atmosphere, which is its
own. I could just see Charlie looking at the time now, like, do I want to go there or not? Like, that means, I could just see, you cannot see it because this is audio only. So, okay, let's go for it. There are two problems.
You baited me. There's the stock of the existing carbon in the atmosphere, and that is already enough of a problem that it will cause, or is already causing significant changes to our environment. But then there's also the flow of carbon. And so that's how do we address adding additional carbon to the atmosphere. And then there's this other element of what is absorbed and by what and over what period of time. And so those, we generally are mostly arguing about the flow, but those other two elements of the problem matter just as much. And so, and soil is only one component of one of the three of those. So I also would not, I don't mean to suggest it is the silver bullet. It's just one of this larger set of tools that I think we have.
Yeah, and then we're getting into a whole different one on cooling and heating and carbon being only a part of that whole discussion, but that's for for another time. And the water cycle series we're actually running. But I want to end it here and be conscious of your time. And thank you so much for the work you do and for coming on here to share about accounting, about banking, and making it interesting and fun to listen to. Because that could be a very boring piece, or people might imagine it's boring, but setting up a bank might be, in this context, the most impactful thing you could do in your regional food system.
I appreciate that. Well, thank you so much for having me. And I hope all of the folks who are listening come and join us as depositors. We'd love to have you.
Moving bank is probably one of the most impactful things you can do, for sure. Or if you are not already banking somewhere, let's say with a conscious.
I appreciate that. So yeah, we're at waldenmutual.com.
I'll put the links below and see you next time.
Thanks so much, Con.
Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. For the show notes and links we discussed in this episode, check out our website, investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/posts. If you like this episode, why not share it with a friend or give us a rating on Apple Podcasts? That really helps. Thanks again, and see you next time.